Well, hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yes, welcome to Sci-Fi, 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 which is usually a book review podcast and featuring audiobooks. But today we are interviewing Meg Ellison. Meg, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. So I wanted to start out talking a little bit about your background. Where are you from originally?
I'm kind of from everywhere. I grew up a military brat, so we lived in Europe, we lived in the South, we lived in the Midwest, lived a great deal on the West Coast. As an adult, I did a lot of the same. I lived in Portland, in California, I moved back to Germany for a little bit, so it's difficult to say I'm from any one place. I like being able to say now I'm from the Bay Area, so I've been doing that.
Well, saying you're from the Bay Area is kind of a way of saying I am from everywhere.
Nobody's really from here. It's kind of terrifying. Everybody seems to be some kind of transplant.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. So can you talk a little bit about not just your latest book, but both of your latest books?
Absolutely. So my first book, my debut novel, is called The Book of the Unnamed Midwife. Mm-hmm. It's a speculative science fiction, post-apocalyptic dystopian novel with a specifically feminist focus. I did a lot of reading in the genre and discovered that almost all of the books have male point of view characters and very male-driven stories, and the women in them are extremely convenient. And there was just this great big hole. So I started feeling the rage and writing books to fill that hole. And then the second book in the same series is called The Book of Edda. It continues the same storyline about 100 years later with a sort of sharp look at generational drift and the way we create societies, and then they become not what we thought they would be. Third book, still forthcoming, is going to be called The Book of Flora, should be out in 2018, and it continues immediately after the end of events in The Book of Edda. So if you're desperately waiting for that third book, I'm going to pick up right where I left off, I promise.
Excellent. Yes. Yeah, we do read a lot of post-apocalyptic novels on this podcast, and there are some repeated tropes. Sometimes it's just, like you say, there's a lot of convenience. Were there particular things that you just hated that you kept on seeing over and over again?
Gosh, so many things. I saw stuff that I hated in books that I liked, which is the hardest thing. So like Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It's a work of genius. Mm-hmm. It deserves all the praise that was given to it. But the character of the wife is very two-dimensional. She barely exists. She's there long enough to give birth to the magical boy and then conveniently disappear. Right. And there are lots of early examples that are far worse, like from the post-nuclear Holocaust dystopias where marital chastity is ensured and nobody has any birth control and yet also no one gets pregnant. Women in these books, regardless of their era, they never menstruate. They have no biological needs that are different from men's needs, like every single possible trope, all the way from being an ornamental sex toy to just being a non-person.
Right. There was actually a line in your book, I don't remember it precisely, but it was that there had been people that seemed to have been waiting for this to happen.
Yeah, there definitely are. And the more that I did my research in how people prepare for the apocalypse, the more I started to recognize the real relish and gusto in the way people count, like, this is what I'm going to do when the power grid goes down, and this is what I'm going to do when the U.S. government is no more. And it's not that they're carefully preparing for a terrible eventuality, but that they're really enjoying this planning. It's a very different way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, we talk sometimes about the cozy catastrophe novels, which are mostly the British pastoral ones where, well, the catastrophe happened, but it now made us sort of better people and, you know, in the end, better men.
Of course, better men. And we get a little bit of that in America. I'm thinking of William Kunstler's World Made by Hand. And he puts a bunch of people in very rural upstate New York, and everybody sort of becomes Amish, and all of their food is cooked in butter, and they ride horses around, and it makes them reliant upon handicrafts and makes them return to the land. It's not all that bad, especially if you're a man.
I'd also like to introduce the other members of the podcast today, which are the space dogs. That would be So Far Barking. That's Hubble and Cosmo. Believe it or not, they came named that way.
They have a lot to say.
They do. Mostly it's woof. Anyway, yeah, I do believe that there is, like you say, a yearning going on when people talk about, you know, well, in the post-apocalyptic world, this is how I would be a hero or something like that. Right. And you definitely had an interesting approach of avoiding a lot of tropes like that.
Yeah, I really didn't want to make a hero who had been waiting for the world to end so that they would finally get their just desserts and not be a male clerk. I also hate competence porn. I see a whole lot of it in this genre and outside of it. There's always an action hero who, you know, the minute he puts his hand on a gun, he's somehow an expert marksman and he's had no training. Or like there's a scene in Midwife where I wrote somebody stealing a sail sailboat. And I was thinking, oh, this can't be that hard. And then I talked to one of my friends who sailed, and they're like, oh, yeah, you probably die.
Yeah.
It's a highly specialized skill. You can't just figure it out. And I'm like, you're right. And that's another just competence porn example. And I wanted to steer so clear of that.
Yeah, I was sort of interested in that because I grew up sailing on the bay. And nice. So it was really, it reminded me a lot of my first sailing lessons where, like, you said something like, and then the thing hit her. And the thing hit me several times when I was learning how to sail.
Yeah, sailboats are full of danger.
There's a reason they call it the boom. That's the sound it makes when it hits you.
That's it.
But on the other hand, you seemed to have a lot of competence when it came to medical knowledge. Do you have a medical background?
A little bit. I studied a great deal of anatomy and physiology because once upon a time, I wanted to be a massage therapist.
Ah, okay.
So I have enough background in the human body to know what I'm looking at. And then for the rest of it, I outsource to experts. One of my very good friends is a nurse midwife.
Oh, so neat.
I was able to ask them lots of technical questions. And the great thing about nurse midwives is they will come back and tell you, let me tell you the worst thing I've ever seen. And then you don't sleep for 3 nights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, my wife being an anesthesiologist who just was on OB call last night. And, occasionally she will just say, oh yeah, we got somebody that was helicoptered in. And well, let's just say then she would tell me a story. Just like, oh, that still happens in civilization? That's not good.
No, I was really lucky. My good friend, they served some time volunteering in less developed nations and areas right. where it's much harder to have children and much more likely to be deadly. And so they've seen some terrible things. Like, they're part of an organization that volunteers midwifery services in Haiti. Mm-hmm. So they were able to tell me, like, people without resources and without know-how, like, these are the mistakes that they make and these are the things that can go wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
When I was reading your book, I was thinking a little bit about Octavia Butler, her Starseed trilogy. There are a few like that. I was wondering, was that possibly one of your influences?
She was a major influence on me. She has a wonderfully practical way of looking at everyday mm-hmm. processes, which is not common in science fiction or speculative fiction, because we tend to look at these problems and say, replicators, faster than light travel. The doctor gave me a pill and it grew a new kidney. And Octavia Butler never does that. Mm-hmm. I started with Kindred and I just sort of fell into the hole of her writings, and she was incredibly, incredibly influential to me. I would say second only to Margaret Atwood, who got right. me rolling on this whole thing. Her book was the first book that I found that had a female point of view.
Right. Exactly. We've become kind of big Margaret Atwood fans on the podcast.
Of course.
One of the things that I think that she doesn't get a lot of credit for is being really funny when she wants to be. I think a lot of us started out with Handmaid's Tale, mm-hmm. and that is so, heart-punching that I'm just like, oh, another Margaret Atwood. I've got to read it, but I'm kind of scared. And then it's just like, oh, that's right. Okay, she's still killing us, but she's kind of laughing while she's doing it.
I think there are very good wry moments in Handmaid's Tale. It's just that the overall effect is such a gut punch that we forget. So I've been mm-hmm. watching the TV show with some friends of mine, and some of them have read the book and some of them haven't. So in places where Alfred is kind of, funny and wry and internally sarcastic, they're like, oh, it's kind of neat that they're lightening the material. I'm like, no, Atwood wrote like that. It's there.
Well, I mean, and it all depends on sort of your point of view. Like, there's the sort of terrifying scene in the beginning where she just happens to notice that there was no way of hanging herself in this room. But if you say that with a slightly wry tone, then it can actually be played for comedy.
It's literally gallows humor.
Exactly.
I know it doesn't usually get classed as speculative fiction because it's such deep future that it almost reads as high fantasy, but I'm really into N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season, The mm-hmm. Stone Sky, The Obelisk. It's such incredible work. I mean, I cannot put it down. It is so good.
Yeah, I was just telling Barry that Book of Edda, the tone is reminding me a lot of N.K. Jemisin.
I don't think that was intentional. After I read a new book, I try to set aside my burning jealousy and my desire to get immediately into their lane aside. But there's always going to be some parallels, especially when I'm reading it and she's so contemporary and she's so brilliant.
Right. And it wasn't that I was noticing any stylistic borrowings or anything like that, but you're both focused on women in a post-apocalyptic world. So there are going to be some things that you both need to cover.
Definitely. And although my books focus more on the importance of gender and the way that our gender is shaped by the times in which we live and the people we live around, mm-hmm. Jemisin is wonderful at positing incidental queerness. And many times it has nothing to do with the actions going around. It has nothing to do with an individual's powers or their destiny. And I love that about her. So I think there's definitely some parallel queerness between the two series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. What was the N.K. Jemisin line? The unexpected penis, I think.
Yes, this is a surprise penis. Yeah.
Surprise penis.
There were a lot of forum posts about that. Like, did I dream that? Did that really happen?
Well, yeah, it was just one of those things where, you know, and it just never really got mentioned again.
No, and it's incidental. It's unimportant.
But one of the differences between yours and hers is that nobody has superpowers in your books.
It's true. So I love books that include magical powers and people with superhuman abilities. I love superhero comics. I'm totally into it. However, there's a vein of bleakness that I really wanted to evoke in my work. And if you start swinging flower-bedecked chairs from the gods, there's no end to what you can avoid. And I really needed to torture those characters. So I try to avoid any too happy coincidences and any too useful abilities. Mm-hmm. But really, in a world like mine, an encyclopedic knowledge of pharmacopoeia or medical skills is almost like a superpower. And one of the things I loved reading about was skill loss and the way that, you know, once people forget how to do things, you can kind of try to teach yourself to read something from books. I mean, even something as simple as knitting. If someone doesn't show you, it's almost impossible to pick up.
Do you think you've actually picked up some useful skills in writing these books? Do you feel more prepared for the coming disaster yourself?
Oh, the coming disaster. I still don't think I'm built to be a survivor. Yeah. I think that I'm one of the early die-offs, unfortunately. I plan to create as much of a diversion for my friends as I can so they can use the time. But if there are fast-moving zombies or a big plague, I mean, I'm not sure that I'm all that equipped to make it. However, if it's a slow unfolding apocalypse that we're facing, and it seems to be that that's the case, I believe I'm more qualified now to deliver a baby in an abandoned warehouse than I was before I wrote these books.
Okay, that's a useful skill.
I also did a great deal of crawling across the United States on Google Street View to see what it would look like if I were riding a bicycle from coast to coast. So I know more about the lay of the land over most of the American West because of this book. And who knows when that may come in handy.
Oh, that could come in very handy. You know, for me, a disaster would be I'm not able to access the internet for an hour.
Yeah, that's pretty much the end of the world for me, too.
So it'd be like, nope, I can't go anywhere. I mean, I'm told that roads connect to each other, but to me now it's only a myth.
Yeah, I've almost forgotten that we used to keep local maps in our cars, like people had them in their glove box, or people used to own the Thomas Guide. And really, everybody should invest in at least a couple of big paper maps, like get yourself to the nearest interstate if you need it to flee type thing. Because if your GPS on your phone doesn't work, what are you going to do?
Oh, right. So have you been doing any disaster prepping of your own?
I'm not a hardcore prepper. I get letters from hardcore preppers, and I realize more and more that I'm not one of these people. But my husband and I keep bug out bags, and that's the most sensible thing. You know, it's got the official earthquake preparedness plus some other stuff that I added because, as I said, the real danger is people. And I got encouraged by some friends of mine who are heavily into W3C and efforts around EFF and stuff like that to keep a bug out bag at work. Mm-hmm. So when I was working in San Francisco, I also had an office version of that bag, which is something a lot of people don't think about. But for many hours of the day, you're not home.
Right, exactly. Though, what does W3C stand for?
It's the, oh gosh, and you're going to ask me, it's like the World Wide Web Commission or something.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize you meant that. The World Wide Web Consortium?
Consortium, that's it.
Okay.
People who are very interested in net neutrality and their ability to access this information are also generally concerned with privacy and the rights of the individual, which lends itself very well to a prepper mentality.
Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense.
People in InfoSec have bug out bags. This is what I have learned.
Yes, well, I do have one, but, well, I have a friend that he does the panels on, you know, preparedness and so forth, and I had him come down here and check out my bug out bag one time. And I wish I'd recorded it because I'm going through it. I'm just like, I don't actually know what this is. And he's just laughing at me. I'm just like, I don't necessarily have food or water, but I have like this board game and this thing where, you know, my wife put it in my bag and I don't actually know what it's for.
Yeah, you really are worried about the internet going down.
Mostly I'm worried about being bored.
Yes.
But maybe, just maybe somehow, you know, pop culture knowledge or just whatever Wikipedia article I was reading that particular day is going to come in handy that day.
So another one of the great speculative novels of the last couple of years that I've been thinking about endlessly since it came out was Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. Mm-hmm. And she really does construct a tribe of people whose main function after the apocalypse is to be amusing.
Yes.
So pop culture knowledge could go a long way. Like if you're going to become a part of a traveling Shakespeare company that goes from town to town making their living, you know, showing something interesting to the people there. It's not so impossible. People need entertainment no matter what the climate is.
Oh, yes. And there was that play, I just saw it recently, about people that go from town to town performing The Simpsons.
Right. They're trying to reconstruct The Simpsons from memory because we all have it so deeply embedded in our psyches. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's called Mr. Burns.
I think that's the name of it. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I saw it when it was in Berkeley, like a year ago, 2 years ago.
I saw it performed at a local girls' high school.
Huh, neat.
Amateur videographer, another story. exactly how we're going to amuse ourselves afterwards is going to be something interesting. Because so in Book of the Unnamed Midwife, there was just a scene where these two characters are trapped in a house together, and the biggest problem is there's nothing to do, and one of them isn't very good at conversation.
That's it. That's one of the things I've hated about Cozy Apocalypse, is people somehow magically end up stuck in a house in, you know, the English countryside with someone that they really like. You know, they have they've common interests, or they have immediate sexual chemistry, or they're like a mm-hmm. family after a couple of days. And I was thinking, the odds are, like, if you had to pick a rando off BART and be like, we're going to be stranded in the apocalypse together, they're going to be boring. They're going to have nothing in common with you. They're going to be incapable of having a conversation if they can't have a total influx of television. So I started thinking, like, how bad could it get? How cabin feverish could you be if you were just stuck with somebody who was dull as dishwater?
But really pretty.
Oh, yeah, but very nice to look at. Yeah.
But not happening. And then.
Yeah, that's drawn entirely from life. I spent way too much time with boring straight girls who I like the look of.
Fair enough. Do you have any other favorite novels or maybe favorite authors?
Gosh, so many. I've recently started writing more horror, and I've got a small cadre of people who really are horror fans who liked the Book of the Unnamed Midwife and the Book of Etta because they were slightly horrifying. Like, people right. like to be scared. So I, like a lot of American kids, grew up on Stephen King. Right. You could always buy cheap hardbacks of Stephen King at the thrift store. You know, pick it up for a dollar, and he often edges into fantasy or edges into science fiction. I mean, he's always got aliens and sewer clowns. And so I would say he was extremely influential on me when I was putting together my writing style. He's so workmanlike. He's so blue collar. And yet I think he's terribly undercredited for what a good writer he is. So
didn't realize what a good writer he was until I read On Writing.
Yeah.
Which is, frankly, I think the best book I've read on writing.
I've read a lot of books in that vein, and I've tried to pick apart different types of advice and people who do it different ways, and there's nothing as valuable as what he puts forth. Even as much of it as memoir. It has to be memoir because you have to understand how he came to know that.
Right. Also, a lot of his advice is just do it.
Get around yourself and do it. Even, I mean, he gets all the way down to like how to position a desk in a room and that you should never have the TV on and like how to carve out time for yourself. I mean, these are really practical problems that everybody has.
Exactly. So there is a book that's about divorce. It's either Meg Ellison or Meg Ellison that wrote a book about divorce. Apparently not you.
This is news to me. No. I have a couple of other writing credits. I'm in a handful of anthologies, and I helped write a nonfiction 50-year retrospective on the free speech movement in Berkeley. It's because I was working for the Daily Californian, and they were putting together a book project, so I got to do a lot of original writing for that and some archiving work, and that was a wild, wild idea. We had people from all over the country send us memorabilia from that time, so we got diary entries and photos and old newspaper articles and all this junk they remember, and pictures of Mario Savio asleep on top of a park bench and just... So I do have some wild and woolly writing credits out there, but not one on divorce.
Okay, fantastic.
Yep.
So you and I have something in common, that we were both English majors.
Yes.
What did you study when you were majoring in English, and do you think that's shaped your writing career at all?
It definitely did shape my writing career. I already knew I wanted to be a writer when I got to Berkeley, and I tried to find different ways to do that. I wrote for the paper there. Mm-hmm. I did some freelancing. I did some copywriting. I've always done a little side work in fixing people's college entry essays.
Oh, very good.
But I didn't know what kind of writer I wanted to be. I didn't have a whole lot of discipline about the craft, and I didn't have the background in the Western canon that you don't have to have, but it really does shape who you are. Mm-hmm. So the good things I got from the program at Berkeley was I was taught to be a close and critical reader.
Right.
And I got a really great span of literature. I got to take Anglo-Saxon literature. I got to take early American literature. I took colonial literature. I got to focus on Brit Lit. I had to read Milton, for the love of God. And one of the greatest things about it was that as long as I formed an argument and got behind it and, you know, showed up with evidence, I could argue anything I wanted. So I got to shit all over Thomas Pynchon and explain why Don DeLillo was a complete poser. And I got to rip apart Ernest Hemingway. One of my favorite moments in one of my Berkeley classes, I was in a class with Ron Lewinson, who's recently passed, but he was a minor luminary in the beat poet era. Mm. He was professor emeritus when I was there. He was, mm-hmm. But he was still very sharp, and he was a wonderful teacher, and he was teaching us The Sun Also Rises.
Sure.
Which is a great book, and every American writer has to have their Hemingway moment, and I had my moment. But Hemingway's heroes are always in some way castrated or impotent. Yeah, it's a thing with him, yes. Right? And he's written this guy who was desperately in love with this woman who is, of course, sleeping with a very young bullfighter, because why wouldn't you?
Of course.
Because masculinity, right? But it's 1925, I believe, and they're all living in Paris. Mm-hmm. And she keeps sleeping with this 19-year-old bullfighter, and she never gets pregnant. So I raised my hand in class because I thought he knew the book better than I did. And I asked, are we supposed to assume that the heroine is barren? And he just sort of blinked his eyes at me. And I'm like, you know, it would be like an analog to Jake's impotence and the loss of his manhood. And he's like, I have no idea. No one's ever asked me that question before. It's 1925. She has no birth control. It's not a question anybody asks because it doesn't matter. Only the men in the story matter. So moments like that just kept adding fuel to this fire of why are these women in these stories never people? Why did they...
Right. Basic biology failures.
Right? Exactly. And it was just this, it was like somebody drilled a hole in the middle of a book and you're like, where's the rest of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had so many wonderful moments of that at Cal, and I learned how to hate read and how to construct from books that already exist the pieces that were missing and to spot the holes in them and say, why hasn't anybody written this book? And what should I be looking harder? And does it exist and I just haven't seen it? In some cases, the answer is yes. And in some cases, the answer is write it yourself.
Well, Pynchon is one author where I have sort of this odd love-hate relationship because I always feel like he's just smarter than I am and is carefully disguising his meaning. I basically stunt read my way through Pynchon. It's just like, I'm going to get through this. No, I don't know why they're singing about bananas. I'm going to get through this.
I think there's a difference between being coy about your intelligence and hiding your meaning and being intentionally obtuse.
Right.
And by the end, I was not convinced that Pynchon wasn't just being intentionally obtuse. He has moments, and then there are lots of times where I'm like, just say it. Just lay it out. Whatever it is you want us to know. It's like watching an episode of Twin Peaks backwards. Pynchon never even tries to make sense.
Yes, although, you know, some parts of Twin Peaks make more sense when you watch it backwards.
Watch it backwards, it's true. Okay, stay out of the red room.
Okay, just to ask, are you watching the new series of Twin Peaks?
Absolutely. No, I'm a lifelong David Lynch fan. And mm-hmm. Even if it doesn't exactly scratch the itch of telling a story, even if it doesn't flow like a normal narrative, he has this wonderful dreamlike quality to his works that I don't really get anywhere else. I think we're seeing the influence of David Lynch in some more unorthodox TV. Like, I'm not sure Legion would exist without him or American Gods. I think he sort of exhausted the box of the American imagination. And so it's a little looser around the edges and we're willing to tolerate some weirder stuff.
Yeah, with David Lynch, I never think, oh, he's trying to fool me into thinking he's more profound than he is. No, David Lynch is doing his thing.
He's doing exactly what he likes, and he's proven that over and over. And what he likes is taking our hand and dragging us through his own personal nightmare country. And I'm here for that.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I really appreciate seeing it after all this time and comparing it to its original legacy and then having it stunt on what it's created in American TV and continue its own legacy of weirdness. It's great.
What else are you watching?
I really love the new Netflix series Glow. Mm-hmm. I think Glow does an awesome job of explaining why wrestling isn't silly, why wrestling is indeed its own form of drama, and how important women's sports were in the crazy days of Foxy Boxing in the 80s, and there are wonderful characters in it. It's definitely another example of Trojan horsing a diverse cast of women in through to boring white women, much like Orange is the New Black, with whom it shares many writers, apparently.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, I've been reading reviews of it, but I haven't actually read it yet. But that's the glamorous ladies of wrestling, I believe?
That's it, yeah. It's definitely worth your time. It's really short and very engaging.
Excellent.
I'm loving American Gods. I'm a mm-hmm. huge fan of the book. I've read it probably 40 times. There's a full cast recording of it as an audiobook, which is eminently worth it. Even if you've already read it, it's performed so beautifully. One of the things I love about the audiobook recording is that Neil Gaiman himself does the interstitial coming to America bits. Mm. So they're told in the voice of the author, and then it goes back to these character voices, and it's so good. Mm. But it's very strange, and it sort of stretches your ideas of what a television show should be and how much backstory somebody can tolerate and how long can we jerk you around in this one particular episode.
Yes. Well, I've promised that I'm going to watch American Gods with a particular friend of mine. So,
so you're waiting.
I'm waiting on that one.
That's the 21st century version of Fidelity. You don't watch the show with anybody but me.
Yeah.
I have a group of friends that I'm like that with Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. So we are eagerly awaiting the next season and seeing how it all ends. And yeah, hopefully people will stop pestering Martin about when the next book will come out because they'll at least have this to waylay them.
Yes, exactly. So you've got another book that you're working on currently?
I actually just finished it.
Oh, wow.
I wrote my first full horror novel, and I'm really excited about it.
Oh, neat.
So I had this idea at the beginning of the year. I got very drunk out with some friends on a Saturday night.
And shocked, I tell you.
I know. It's terrible. And I called a Lyft to get me home, and I like to say that I fell asleep, but I more accurately passed out in the back seat. I was insensible, and I had a wonderful and responsible driver who was not a creepy person who drove me home and then woke me up. And I mean, it took some effort to wake me up and told me, "Hey, you're home." So I thanked him and I tipped him and I gave him 5 stars and I sent him on his way. And then I'm standing on my own doorstep and like trying to groggily fish my keys out of my pocket, and I suddenly have this moment like, you could have woke up anywhere.
Yeah.
You could have ended up absolutely anywhere. You put your complete trust in a stranger and then passed out in their backseat. Like, what were you thinking?
Right. We've taken an essential part of our infrastructure and just said, just anybody now.
Strangers. Yeah. Anybody. And most of the time it works out. Like, I use Rideshare maybe 3 times a week, but all it takes is one. So I went in thinking I'm going to slink into my bed and I'm going to fall asleep and I'm going to wake up with a hangover and a headache, but I'll at least like be out of this.
Right.
And I couldn't sleep. And I sat up at my laptop and pounded out like the first 6,000 or 7,000 words of what would become this book.
Oh, fantastic.
Very excited.
Yes. And did I see from your social media you've gone bowling recently?
A couple of times. So a good friend of mine is getting married at the end of this month, and she didn't want to have a traditional bachelorette party. So she suggested that we all go bowling, which we all said, fine, you know, it's cheap, it's fun, we can do it without causing too much attention or stir or problems. But she said everybody should come dressed as a bride. So we descended on Albany Bowl last night, and there were about 30 people of various gender expressions in wedding dresses. I have this huge fluffy crinoline, and I wore that, and there were more than a few hoop skirts. There were some 80s dresses. There were some 50s dresses. There were some very fringy second wedding in Vegas type dresses. A lot of men showed up in various like prom dresses, bridesmaids dresses. We were a spectacle. It was amazing. And then the intended groom for this wedding showed up, and he was the only groom. You know, he showed up in his Robert Palmer, very 80s skinny tie. So we were bowling for hours, and it was really fun, and it looked super great. And we took a million pictures, and then when we went from there to karaoke, and we set him up so that he had to sing White Wedding, and then we just sort of swarmed the dance floor so that he's singing White Wedding with a crowd of like 30 brides. So people are in the bar are like, is this a flash mob? What's happening?
Technically, yes.
Technically, we did flash mob it, yeah. But it's a really good idea. If you're looking for an unconventional way to throw yourself a bachelorette or a bachelorette party, I recommend having 30 people pub crawl in wedding dresses, because only good comes of it.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. You also won the Philip K. Dick Award.
I did, 2014. I was extremely lucky to win that award. I'm still blown away that it happened. The first time the book was published, it was published through a very small press in Los Angeles called Sybaritic. Sybaritic Press gave me my very first book deal. I was super excited. I had no exposure. I had no idea about publishing. Like, I knew the thinnest amount. Of course, I thought I knew everything. I didn't have an agent. I just jumped right in. Mm-hmm. So I had previously published some anthologies with them, and they knew me. And then I mentioned at a party that I had a novel, and they said, great, let us see your novel. So all of this happens. The book ends up on the short list for the Philip K. Dick Award, which I figure at the time is the coolest thing that is ever going to happen to me. And I started looking at the authors that I was nominated with, and I'm so outclassed. I mean, Rod Duncan is an incredible steampunk author from the UK. Emiya Taranta is this fantastic Finnish author who does her own translations in English and in French, and The Memory of Water is an incredible book. Jennifer Marie Brissett wrote this incredibly ambitious work about, it's a retelling of the story of Hadrian and Antinous, but the world is being rebooted and rebooted and rebooted by a supercomputer.
It
blew me away. And Cherie Priest and her Lizzie Borden retelling. I mean, I was really outclassed. So I sat down and I bought all of their books and I read them and I sort of like stacked them up over and over. And I was like, okay, this one's going to win and then this one will take second. Okay, but this one's going to win and this one will take second. But I never for a second thought I was going to win. I was just like, this is some dark horse territory. So I got to go to NorwestCon, which is a wonderful con. It's extremely well run. They have great admin. And that's where I met George R.R. Martin, who was super gracious, great guy. And I kept thinking, like, this is the coolest thing that's ever going to happen to me. I get to go to the awards ceremony. I get to pal around with these real writers. And then I'll go home. So I was not prepared in any way when I won. I didn't have an acceptance speech. I hadn't thought about the consequences in the slightest.
So did you just improv an acceptance speech?
I did improv, which is why the first words out of my mouth was, does holy shit count as an acceptance speech? I ended up coming up with some kind of half-baked metaphor that I was thinking, like, this is beyond the prince goes home with Cinderella. This is the prince goes home with a pumpkin. Like, nobody saw this coming, least of all me. So the best thing that came out of winning the Philip K. Dick Award, and it's hard to say because it's definitely like made my life different. My husband is a librarian. He works for the County of Marin here in California. And on the day after I won, he went to work and he was so proud. He was just busting to tell everybody, and everybody was already sick of it by then. So what he did was he took all the library's public computers and he turned their homepage to the announcement that I'd won the Philip K. Dick Award. So this woman walks in and she's turning her books in and she's looking around and she's like, what is this, some kind of gag? Like, did one of you write this book? What's going on? So John's, you know, strutting around with his thumbs under his suspenders and he's like, no, my wife wrote this book. So like some kind of fairy tale, this woman says, really? Does she have literary representation? Because I'm an agent. So John, foaming at the mouth, gives her my card and says, no, my wife doesn't currently have literary representation. So she turned out to be my agent, Danielle Svetkoff at LGR in New York. She just happens to live in Marin. And she's like, you're kidding me. This is going to sell like a mad bastard. Come on. So she got me my second deal. She got me the two-book deal for Midwife and Flora, and she's still representing me today. And it opened every door in every way, and the PKD committee and the Philadelphia Science Fiction Society were such nice people. I mean, that was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
All right. Well, I think that's all I got. Thank you very much, Meg. It's been great talking to you.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you very much.